Jerry Barker has joined us on Sports Byline USA. Again, I want to recommend this book. It's called Undefeated. Jerry, there were some characters, a lot of the characters on Lou Holtz's teams as well. And I want to start with one group, the linebackers, the Three Amigos. Tell me about them.
These guys were nuts. Wes Pritchett, the middle linebacker and the defensive signal caller, Frank Stams and Michael Stonebreaker. And Pritchett and Stams in particular, I mean, they were characters. They'd be blowing boogers on each other in practice. Wes Pritchett would hike up his jock strap up over his shoulders and walk around with just that in the locker room and look to have serious conversations with underclassmen. You know, Stams would be sitting there, he was a washed up fullback under Jerry Faust, and Coach Holtz comes in and he moves over to the defensive side and becomes an All-American in this one season. And they'd be doing out of town interviews, and Frank Stams would pretend he was Wes Pritchett, and in the midst of the interview with an out of town journalist, he'd say, "You know, I'm pretty good, but you got to talk about that Frank Stams guy. I mean, there's an All-American." and Pritchett, who's the craziest of the three of them, probably. His tradition was to work out on Sunday mornings after games and do curls in the mirror. He would drop his shorts to his ankles and recite soliloquies of Shakespeare as he did curls. I mean, I don't know if it gets much quirkier than that.
And they used to leave tickets for somebody, too, didn't they?
That's true. That's true. Frank Stams left tickets for Elvis Presley and for the Miami game. He left tickets for Elvis. It made the papers. And a few weeks later, they asked him, they said, "Hey, did Elvis show up at the game?" And Stams quipped right back and said, "Yeah, I got a note from him." He said, "Thanks. He sat on the 30-yard line. He said he was looking forward to the USC game, so I'm going to leave him tickets for that game, too." And I'll tell you, to the day, Stams doesn't deny this. He doesn't deny that he left tickets for Elvis.
How did Lou deal with these individual personalities? I mean, he's a football coach. He needs to keep some type of control, but how did he deal with these guys?
Well, the one thing the players said was that they respected his ability. They had a certain level of self-expression and individuality, but when it came down to it, they knew they were always going to subjugate themselves for the greater good of the team. And Barry Alvarez was a first-year defensive coordinator with this team, and what he did is he would bring in the linebackers to his office and tell him what he needed that week from them. And he empowered that leadership for them to go and lead the charge. He knew he could light the fire of the team through those linebackers. And Lou is a great motivator. There's no doubt about that, and he gets the best out of his players. And he took a different approach with different players. I mean, Tony Rice, he was unmerciful with him in practice. I mean, at one point in the season, they're going to play Michigan State, and he sends Tony Rice down to the practice squad because he's dissatisfied with his play. And Tony Rice will tell you, you know, it was uncomfortable. He didn't like it. But part of the reason he's the man who he is today is because of Lou Holtz, and he's completely grateful for it.
Tell me about the 5-foot walk-on kicker Lou had.
Well, Reggie Ho was something else. Reggie Ho is a pre-med student, and he was a walk-on. He had tried out for the team. And Lou, another thing, Lou would be hard on kickers. He would stand there and right next to him as they're kicking in practice, and he would be talking to him as they're lining up. And Reggie Ho, eventually, after trying out for a couple years, he made the cut of the team. And then he just began to use visualization and these sort of voodoo jazz hands. He'd have his head down in almost a yoga lunge, and the ball would snap. His head would stay down. He'd look straight at the ball, kick. He never even looked at the ball as it went through the uprights. He would just listen for the crowd. And he became a folk hero that season because he kicked 4 field goals against Michigan in the opener in the season, which Notre Dame won by 2 points, and people were just enamored with him, and his course load ended up getting shown on ESPN and in magazines because people were just enamored with this little diminutive fellow who didn't even want a scholarship, wasn't going to use his next year of eligibility, just loved Notre Dame and wanted to kick field goals for him.
Certainly the big game, and it's one of the greatest in college football history, was that game against then number one Miami, coached by Jimmy Johnson. And it turned out to be one of those memorable games for a lot of different reasons, aside from what happened on the field. But it was billed as Catholics versus convicts. Pick it up from there.
Well, I don't think we're going to get a college football rivalry that was as culturally galvanizing as this one. Notre Dame wanted revenge, and really even Miami beat them 58-7 in 85, and that one still stung for the Irish, even though the Irish had played them in 1987 and lost 24-0. People were still talking about that 58-7 game. And, you know, Miami had put its players on the police blotter, though there were not many criminal charges. Mostly it was community service is how that was handled. And in a Dillon Hall dorm room on the campus of Notre Dame, students hatched this T-shirt, Catholics versus Convicts. And it caught on like wildfire. I mean, they had alumni clubs were ordering T-shirts from these students. They had people wanting to pay $50 or $100 for a T-shirt these kids were selling for $10. And the national media loved it. And everybody who was writing a story about it included it. And the vitriol was certainly there between the fans. And then on the field, Notre Dame was a team that just wasn't going to be messed with in 1988. And when in the pregame, when Miami players decided they were going to put on a show and go through the Notre Dame warm-ups, Notre Dame was having none of it, and a free-for-all just broke out. Had to be broken up by police and stadium security. And it, for Notre Dame, as Rocket Ismail has said, it was like punching a bully in the face for the first time. And they proved something to themselves in that pregame. And, you know, they're in the locker room before the game starts, and they're going nuts. They come back with Miami Hurricane helmets, and they're smashing them against lockers. And, you know, Frank Stams has spit flying from his mouth talking to the defense. And Tony Rice's hands are pulsating because there your quarterback was just throwing uppercuts. And Lou Holtz comes in, and they get silent, and they figure, man, they're gonna hear it from him because they've disrespected Notre Dame, our mother, and this university they're supposed to represent. And Coach Holtz says, you know, you'll be fine today. Don't worry, you'll be fine. And he says a couple other things, and he tells him, he says, just do me one favor. Save Jimmy Johnson's ass for me. And they just took off. He had more to say. He actually said, I had more to say. But when they heard that, they took off out of the tunnel and went onto the field.
What was the turning point in the victory in that game? Because Notre Dame wins it 31-30. But what was the key moment or moments in that game for the victory?
Well, when it comes down, I mean, the Irish were up 21-7. And to show you how good Miami was and their resiliency, they come back and tie the game before halftime. And Miami, in the fourth quarter, Notre Dame didn't move the ball past the 50-yard line. Miami was constantly knocking on the door, so the key play came down to the two-point conversion. And it's funny because Miami had come back just a few weeks earlier. They had played up in Ann Arbor against the University of Michigan, and they were down 30-14 in that game. And Steve Walsh, the All-American quarterback and Heisman Trophy finalist, was an unflappable leader of that offense. And he led the Canes back against Michigan without using a timeout in 7 minutes and beat Michigan 31-30. So Miami had all the confidence in the world. In their mind, this is what they did. They just won games. It didn't matter what the score was or how much time was left. So it came down to this two-point conversion play, and I talked about it with everybody involved, and Steve Walsh said it wasn't a mystery as to what play we were going to run. It was the same play we ran up at Michigan. And Barry Alvarez said, we knew what they were going to run, and I knew the defense. I was going to drop eight guys and rush three. So the ball snaps, and George Boo Williams gets a good rush, an up rush, and Walsh, when Leonard Connolly, a back out of the backfield, is open, he has to pump the ball rather than throw it, and then he has to float it to the back corner of the end zone where Pat Terrell, a guy who was a quarterback at Notre Dame and then converted to a receiver and then converted to a defensive back, makes the deflection. And that really, that moment is the national championship-saving moment. If that doesn't happen, Notre Dame, who knows, we might be talking about 35 years since Notre Dame's last national championship.
You know, I've always thought a lot about Lou Holtz and just the standard that he set for the way he was going to conduct himself and his team would. And that game against USC, now, what was behind the suspensions of both the team's leading rusher and receiver?
Well, it's very funny because it really is an issue of tardiness. And in the book, Lou spoke to me about it very openly, and so did Tony Brooks, the team's leading rusher. And the truth was, these guys were late to a Thanksgiving dinner before the team took off for California, 45 minutes late. And Lou gave them a proper upbraiding about that and told them, look, if you're late again, you're not going to play. Do not let this happen. And less than 24 hours later, they borrowed somebody's car and went to a mall in California with a couple other players on the team. And when they came out of this mall, they forgot where they parked the car. And I've talked to the other players that were with them. So this isn't made up. It sounds kind of hokey and weird, but they couldn't find the car and they were 45 minutes late. And that's when Lou said, you're out. I mean, he couldn't believe it. He was flabbergasted. Couldn't believe that 24 hours later they were late again. And the players couldn't believe it. You know, Tony Brooks and Ricky Waters ended up in the Chicago airport watching the USC game, and they were shocked that they weren't playing it. They didn't think he'd pull the trigger. And actually what Lou did is he turned it over to the team and also let them decide and them take a vote. So that, you know, and they voted to send him home. Some of the guys wanted him even kicked off the team, and a couple other guys said, no, they should play. But eventually the team voted to send him home.
There's so much in this book for people to understand, read, and appreciate. And I want to touch on one other thing before I kick you loose, and that was about Tony Rice, because he had to face a lot of adversity in getting to Notre Dame. Academically, you know, he wasn't one of those top students, but on the football field, he was 31-4 as a starting quarterback. Talk to me a little bit more about Tony.
Well, you know, Tony Rice, I think when we look at option quarterbacks who have won national championships, I think he's too often overlooked, and people think of Tommy Frazier and Jamel Holloway. And Tony Rice is right up there, and particularly what he faced leaving the state of South Carolina, dealing with the racism from people there and letters that followed him to Notre Dame because he left South Carolina and chose to go to Notre Dame, being an academic question mark, even though he ended up graduating with his class and is successful in business today. He's a very unique character because oftentimes, and I'm sure you've seen this in following sports, a lot of these guys will have a chip on their shoulder or some sort of me against the world, I'll show them attitude. And I have to tell you, that's not there with Tony Rice. He faced this with a smile. His grandmother told him, kill him with kindness. And that's what he did. He just smiled and worked hard and worked hard and worked hard. And his linemen, his offensive linemen till this day, still love him. He would pick them up after plays, and it would shock them. And he always got up, no matter how hard a lick he took, he would spring up to his feet, because he never wanted the defense to know that they got a good shot in. And I remember talking to Gary Moeller about a Michigan. Gary Moeller was a defense coordinator in Tony Rice's area. He was a defensive coordinator at Michigan. And he said to me about the game in 1989, he said, yeah, we shouldn't have kicked the ball to Rocket Ismail, who had two kickoff returns for touchdowns. He said, but you look at Tony Rice, look at his stat line. And he was one of two for 12 yards on a touchdown pass. And Gary Moeller said, that guy led that offense to nearly 400 yards, and he only had to throw two passes. Tony Rice was the key to that. And I think that speaks volumes to his leadership ability and his approach to things.
We only have 30 seconds left, Jerry, but what would you like people to take away from this book?
Well, I just want people to enjoy it and enjoy the nostalgic trip back to really college football in the late 1980s and this Notre Dame team, because it does capture that before we're oversaturated with games that we are today, it's something special back then.
Congratulations on this book. I'm just looking forward to reading it through from cover to cover, and I urge other people to check it out as well. It's called Undefeated, the Story of Notre Dame's Last National Championship, and you are welcome here anytime on Sports Byline. Jerry, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jerry Barca is the author of this fine book, writes for the New York Times, also senior writer at Sports Illustrated. And that was back in 1988 was their last national championship. The Fighting Irish defeated number one Miami. And they also went on to defeat number two and number three. Number two was USC. Number three was West Virginia. We continue on Sports Byline.